have so many questions for you.
Well, my only hope and prayer is that you don't get done before I do, okay? Well, I'm sure that some of you, as has been my practice for 6 decades plus, wake up in the morning grateful to God that I'm alive and can move and walk and think, and I take out a little piece of the Bible and start reading for a little while until I really get awake. And I found that every time I read sections that I thought I knew everything about it, something else pops up that I hadn't recognized before. So I'm going to read 2 very familiar sections for you, and maybe, just maybe, something will pop up for you as well. The first is from the book of Exodus. It's about the pilgrimage from Egypt over to the Promised Land. And Moses, as you know, had a little trouble. He discovered very early in life that he was a Jew and not an Egyptian. And I don't know how old he was when he discovered that he had to look out for his brothers and sisters, and he did that. And unfortunately, one day there was an Egyptian soldier that was beating a Jewish brother in kind of his. And Moses had a temper, apparently, and so he killed the soldier. I guess it was a temper. So he runs for his life, and you know the narrative. He goes off into the distant land and tries to run away from God. That's the part that I keep picking up on. You can't quite get away from God, no matter how hard you try. And he gave all kinds of excuses, as you know, as to why, when God called him to go back to Egypt to free the slaves from their 400 years of slavery, he had similar traits that many of us do. He had the ability to make all kinds of excuses. But his major excuse was he stuttered, "I don't speak clearly." And God said, "I'll take care of that. I'll send your brother with you, Aaron, who speaks very clearly," as you know the narrative. So they are on the journey. It's a long journey. It took 400 years. No, 40. But it seemed like 400. And one of my theologian friends says, if you clock the map with your map quest from Egypt to the Promised Land, and if they took 40 years to get there, they traveled at the exorbitant rate of speed of about 12 inches a day. Now, whether that's true or not, who knows, but they didn't get there quickly. But on the way, all kinds of things happened, and one of the tasks of Moses was to teach the people the laws of God. And you know the narrative that Moses is called to go up on the mountain, and while he's on the mountain, God does the gift of the Ten Commandments, and it says that God wrote the commandments with God's own hand. So I pick up. And then Moses turned and went down the mountain carrying the 2 tablets of the covenant in his hands, tablets written on both sides, written on the front and on the back. The tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God, engraved upon the tablets. When Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, "There is a noise of war in the camp." But he said, "It is not the sound of victors or the sound made by losers. It's the sound of revelers that I hear." And as soon as he came near the camp and saw the calf and dancing, Moses' anger burned hot, and he threw tablets from his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. And he took the calf they had made, burned it in the fire, ground it into powder, scattered it onto the waters, and made the Israelites drink it. What about that? And Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you have brought so great a sin upon them?" And Aaron said, "Do not let the anger of my Lord burn hot, and you know the people, and they are bent on evil, and they said to me, 'Make us gods who shall go before us.' And as for Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. So I said to them, 'Whoever has gold, take it off.' So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf." Pretty magic, huh? Just pitch the gold in the water. On the next day, Moses said to the people, "You have sinned a great sin, but now I will go up to the mountain of the Lord. Perhaps," interesting, "perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." So Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, the people has sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold. But now if you will only forgive their sin. But if not, blot me out of the book that you have written. But the Lord said to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of the book. But now go, lead the people to the place about which I have spoken to you. See, my angel will go before you. And then a familiar section from Luke's Gospel. On the next day, when the disciples had come down from the mountain, a great crowd met Jesus. Just then a man from the crowd shouted, Teacher, I beg you to look at my son. He is my only son. Suddenly spirit seizes him, and all at once he shrieks, and it throws him into convulsions until he foams at the mouth. It mauls him and will scarcely leave him. I begged your disciples to cast it out, but they could not. Jesus answered, You faithless and perverse generation, how much longer must I be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here. When he was coming, the demon dashed him to the ground in convulsions. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. And all were astounded at the greatness of God. While everyone was amazed at all that he was doing, he said to his disciples, Let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into human hands. But they did not understand that saying. Its meaning was concealed from them, so they did not perceive it. And they were afraid to ask him about the saying. Then an argument arose among them as to which one of them was the greatest. Can you imagine the scene? Predicting his death. Such human beings we are. An argument arose among them, but Jesus, aware of their inner thoughts, took a little child and put it in his side and said to them, Whoever welcomes this child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me, for the least among all of you will be the greatest. This is God's word for us. Well, I spoke very briefly last night that when the title came, some people thought maybe I was going to talk about something that's going on in this country, and I'm not. I'm not even interested at this point. I didn't cause it. I can't fix it. I'm a Presbyterian. I believe in the providence of God. But I want to talk about leadership. There are two things that I've discovered in my brief lifetime that are the greatest threat to leadership, and that is the refusal on the part of those of us who have the ability to lead to refuse to lead, and there is a vacuum, and nature abhors a vacuum. And what happens in that vacuum is that in every institution, nations, every organization, every church, every family, every individual, the increasingly number of incompetent people, self-serving, rise up to take the leadership roles, and we suffer the consequence. But I want to talk about leadership from the vantage point of a Christian, not from the national scene, but from a Christian's vantage point. I think by the grace of God, every single one of us is called to be a leader where we are, not somewhere else, but where we are. And authentic leaders recognize the capacity to lead so that it isn't self-serving, but it serves their contingency around them, family, friends, acquaintances. So authentic leaders, who are they? Lessons of history teach us that they usually rise out of the midst of the arena where people didn't think leadership could come. So I'm going to give you four very brief case studies, and if you get a score of 100, I'll stop. No, I'm teasing. In fact, the greatest leaders that I have read about, and one of my hobbies now is biography. I'm not a reader of novels. Many people love novels, and that's wonderful. I'm glad you read them. But I learn much more from biography. And this I learned about these four case studies. From the earliest of her childhood days, Ellie's mother disliked her because she was so homely looking. And when she was 6 years old, her father was put in a sanitarium for alcoholics. And when she was 10 years old, her mother and her brother died, and she was sent to live with her grandmother, who disliked her passionately. She refused to let her have friends. She made her to wear old-fashioned clothes. She laughed at her constantly. And although she was very bright and the family had money, she was not permitted to go to college. Case number two. As a child, Goldie lived near a police station, and she heard the screams of political prisoners being tortured. Her family left Europe, and they moved to Milwaukee to escape the potential of torture. Goldie was 8 years old. Her family bought a store in Milwaukee, and she was not permitted to go to school because they made her work in the store. At age nine, she ran away from home. She went to live with her sister in Denver. Case number three. Born of Jewish parents in an area where Jews were hated, Al was slow in learning how to talk. He had great difficulty in school. His father despised him because he had no athletic ability. During his senior year in high school, he had a nervous breakdown and missed 6 months of school. He had no friends. He was shy. He was lonely. But he made up his mind in his solitude about the nature of God. And he concluded that we will never, ever, ever discover all that God has created. He failed in his first attempt to get into college. He was finally admitted. He was such a terribly poor student, they didn't think he would ever graduate. And upon his graduation, his professors told him he would never amount to anything. Case number four, Tom. During his first year of school, the teacher complained that he was always daydreaming and finally concluded that he was mentally ill and told his mother to take him out of school, and she did. Throughout his childhood, he continued to experiment with things, taking things apart and putting them back together. All the neighbors thought he was crazy. His father thought he was so strange that he never even spoke to him. So often with great cruelty, you see how we treat people, but frequently they succeed regardless of how they've been treated. So the guesswork is over. Ellie obviously was Eleanor Roosevelt. Goldie was obviously Golda Meir, the first woman prime minister of Israel. Al obviously was Albert Einstein. Tom was obviously Thomas Alva Edison. You scored 100. But you see, the story is how often we reject and ignore the potential in people, and maybe not just in people, but we ignore the potential in ourselves. Authentic leaders, who are they? They're the people just like you and me. We're not just common people. We're a gift of God, made in the image of God. God gives us the raw material in life, and then we are to turn it into something worthwhile that benefits the world in which we live. And that makes human life not only better for ourselves, but for people around us and in other places. I cannot tell you how many times in my ministry people have said to me, you know, I'm a John Calvinite, and I believe in predestination, and I think that at birth God pre-programmed me, and all I have to do is speak the words and act the part. That's not what predestination is. Even if you're a Methodist, you know better than that. That's not predestination. The entire script is not given to us in advance. Never forget, God wills for us, but God never coerces. We are invited along the way. We're invited by God to become partners with God in the world in which we live. We're not puppets. We're not puppets. It becomes clear to me, at least over the decades of life, that the problem has never been with God. It's always been with us. Remember, Eleanor Roosevelt is attributed with this line, "No one can make you feel inferior without your consent." It is so true, and often the world has tried to make the church feel inferior, even to make Christians feel inferior. I'm at the end of my journey somewhere along the way. My cardiologist said, when I asked him how much longer he thought I would live, and he said, "Until you die." That's not very helpful, but it's encouraging, isn't it? So reaching this age in life, and it's not old as you know anymore, I'm able to speak candidly about myself and my confessions. I was chairman of what was called the Bicentennial Fund of the Presbyterian Church from 1986 to 1992 or 3. I had a wonderful church in Fort Worth that permitted me to travel And I traveled a great deal, almost 1.5 miles in 6-7 years. I was on an airplane more than I was home, as my wife keeps reminding me. My confession is that often I was upgraded without request because I was a frequent flyer. And frequently I was in a seat, usually my favorite seat on the old 707s, and the 737s was 3A up in the bulkhead. I got on a plane in Dallas-Fort Worth and I was going to Philadelphia, and I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want anybody to know. I never told very many people that I was a minister. Usually it shuts them off, you know. I just didn't want to talk about it. The guy on the ground got the seat in 3B. He ordered a martini right away before we got in the air, and the second one before we left. I thought, this is going to be a fun ride. And as soon as we got in the air, he ordered the third one, and finally, I guess he took that to get the courage, and he said, what do you do? I said, well, I'm in sales. Well, what do you sell? I said, well, it's a very specialty product. We have quite a few outlets. We have 11,750 of them just in the United States. And we have 183 regional bodies and 18 other regional bodies. And then we have a big, big, big general headquarters. His eyes were about that big around, I'm going to tell you. And we chatted on, and I said, well, I may as well finish the story to you. I said, we not only have that, but we have about 90 million employees around the world. And he said, give me your card. I think I could be helpful to you. And I said, I'll tell you what, if you want to drink the rest of the way, fine, but I'm busy working and I'd like to do my corporate responsibilities. I'll give you my card when we land. It's a good story. I'm ashamed of it to some degree because you ought to tell people what you do. There's no shame in being a minister at all, none. We landed at Philadelphia Airport and he grabbed my hand. He said, give me your card. And I gave him my card and it had Reverend Robert W. Bowl on it. And he said, oh my God, I'm so glad to see you. He said, as you know, I'm an alcoholic. I said, well, I don't know that, but you did have a fair amount to consume in the flight. He said, I'm a deacon at the First Baptist Church in Dallas. Dr. Criswell is my pastor, and he doesn't know I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I think I can help you. I live in Fort Worth, and I'd be glad when I get home in a few days to come and visit you. But the condition is you have to go with me where I want to take you. And he said, where's that? And I said, he said, to church? I said, no. In a way, it's church. It's an Alcoholic Anonymous meeting. That was in about 1986 or 7. He's not living now. He was in his 60s then. But God intervened. I didn't do it. God intervened, and the man became sober. And from that moment on, I have never been, quote, ashamed to tell my seatmate what I do. Doesn't mean I want to talk. It just means I want to be honest with God and with my responsibilities. Because I think that's a part of what it means to be a Christian, to be authentic. It wasn't that I'm ashamed of the profession. I just didn't want to get involved. God never coerces. God always invites so that we can become partners with God. Sometimes I hear otherwise very committed Christians say, you know, if only I had more money, if only I had more time, if only I had more talent. And I said, if only you read the New Testament and looked at the life of Paul, he never used the word if only. He didn't even use the word in spite of. He simply did what God asked him to do, and he wrote most, if not all, of the letters of the New Testament. Bunyan, as you know, wrote Pilgrim Progress while he was in jail. Beethoven wrote his greatest music, so musicians tell me, when he was completely deaf. No one should consider themselves irresponsible. Some months ago, I don't know, you get those phone calls when you don't know who's on the other end and you don't want to answer it, but you think, well, maybe it's important, whatever. And we get them in Florida now. It says, out of area, area code 239. Well, if it's out of area, it's not area code 239. This one wasn't that. It was a number, an 800 number, and I thought, well, maybe I should answer it. And it was one of those ladies doing a questionnaire. And I said, I'm really quite busy. She said, it'll only take 2 minutes. I said, okay, fine, let's get on with it. What is your vocation, she asked. I said, Christian. She said, I didn't ask you what you do. I asked you, what is your vocation? I said, Christian. Well, what do you do? I said, I'm a Christian. I do what Christians do. She didn't like that at all, I can imagine. There were a number of other questions, but there were two that lingered on, and I will not ever forget them. First one was, now I've had enough of you, and I want to ask you one question, and I want a yes or no answer, no commentary, okay? Question was, do you consider yourself a responsible leader? How do you answer that? I was thinking to myself. She said, answer it. I said, I'm thinking. I was thinking, to whom am I responsible as a leader? Today, am I responsible to you or the churches I served? Am I responsible to my wife, my children, my grandchildren? Or am I only responsible to God? And I said, I can't answer the question. She said, next question. So you are a Christian. That's what you do. Has anyone ever believed in God because of you? Now think about that. Don't make it my question. It's your question. Has anyone ever believed in God because of you? Won't go away, will it? It's just there. Then you think back about Moses and what he had to do taking those people from Egypt into the Promised Land. I don't need to repeat the narrative. You know what happened from the mountain, the Ten Commandments, broke the commandments, melted the golden calf into powder, made the Israelites drink the water. When I read about the people like Moses, I often like to sit back for a moment after I read a line or two and think about what went on in the mind of Moses when he came down from the mountain, because God had chosen only Moses to lead the people into the Promised Land out of slavery. What went through the mind of Moses when he came down and they were worshiping a golden calf? But you remember the first commandment, I'm the Lord your God, and you shall have no other gods before me, and you shall not worship idols, graven images. What went on in the mind of Moses when he came down and all these Jews had totally rejected what he had tried to do? What went on in his mind? Do you think, I'm a failure? Is that what Moses was saying to himself? I didn't do what I should have done? Well, apparently he believed that, because he had a long conversation with God after his anger quieted down, and he blamed himself. He didn't blame the people. That's what authentic leaders do. You can't raise the blame to somebody else. But what caught my attention in all of this is the punctuation. It is the only place in the whole Bible where you find an unfinished sentence. You can go back and read it. It's in chapter 32 of Exodus. The only place where there's an unfinished sentence. He gets to the sentence, it doesn't end, there's a dash. It's literally printed in the English Bibles as a dash, a slash mark. This people have sinned a great sin, but if thou wilt forgive their sin, dash. What does the dash mean? Does it represent the reality of Moses' great moment of his own doubt? Will God forgive? When Moses blames himself for the failure of the people? Well, what I'm reading in biographies and from the Bible is that authentic leaders bear the responsibility of their own actions. You can't blame somebody else. I can't tell you how many people have been to my office. You know, if my dad had loved me more, I wouldn't be like this. Yeah, I can give you know, what I'm talking about. We're con artists. We blame God for everything and others, but not ourselves. So Moses says in the ultimate expression to God, if you will not forgive them, do not blame them. Blame me. Blot me out of the book of life. Well, you know what God, I read it to you, what God said. Go back to the mountain. Get a new set of commandments. And that's where the Luke passage comes in about Jesus announcing his imminent death. And he says, whoever becomes like a little child and welcomes me, my Father will welcome them. And the greatest among you will be those we consider the least today. So it's still true. You know, people can avoid making up their mind about God. And I know a lot of people who say they've already done that. They've not made up their mind about God. They're not going to. But they already have. You know why? Because their life bears exactly what they believe about God. It's not what they say with their mouth. It's what they do with their life. I love speaking to people who are a bit older than I am to ask them about their regrets, if they have any. And the most positive elderly people I deal with say to me, the only regret I have is that I will not see all of those good things I work for, but the next generation will complete them. That's what we do. So Moses never entered the promised land, as you recall. He died just as he looked over the mountain into it, and no one knows where he's buried. But he completed what God had asked him to do. That's the important thing. I'm looking back on life. I'm trying to fill in some gaps in my own life. How did I get to where I am and all of those things? What I remember most about my ministry is the people that have said things to me after I've long left that church and gone to another. 3 months ago, I received a letter from a man who was in one of the churches I served. And he told me that while I was there as a pastor, he had never attended a church for 40 years, had no interest in God, and wasn't interested then until he kept watching what was going on in the church. And forgive me for the personal part of this. He said, and I had my eyes focused directly on you day after day. I watched every move you made. I didn't want to become a Christian. But the reason I finally decided to join the church after 40 years and to become a Christian is simply because of you. I have a hard time believing all this stuff that Jesus said about love and so on. But there's one thing I know. You believed it. And I knew that you trusted him. And for a long time I've been watching you to see how you've handled the bitter and the sweet in your life. And I could see how much of a difference your faith in Christ has made in your life. And I want to be a Christian. Because I've seen something in you I want for myself. That was 60 years ago. I had forgotten the scene. It's a very humbling experience to know that one little incident like that introduced a man who had no use for the church, no use for the Christian gospel, no use for Christ, but became a Christian. And so I wrote in my notes when I was thinking about that email from him, it's a very frightening thing to ponder that someone, every moment in your life, someone is deciding for or against believing in Christ, in God, because of what they see in you and me. Well, I raise the question, you can give the answer. What do people see in you? What do they see in how you handle the bitter and sweet in your life? And we all have them. What do they see in you would make them want to be like you if you truly believe in Christ? So never forget, every moment of your life, someone is making up their mind for or against what you claim to believe in your own life about Jesus Christ. 24 minutes. Told you to be 25. We can stop here or you can ask questions of each other because you have more wisdom than I do on these subjects. Yes.
I just wanted to thank you for coming. You know, I know it was a great sacrifice.
Thank you.